Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin wins more national and international cheese awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, jumping in to tell you about this week's episode of Meat and Three, Heritage Radio Network's weekly food roundup. This week, we're introducing you to some amazing women taking a stand.
So often, being sexually harassed feels like a loss of control. And so I wanted to have these very tangible guides to say, here's what you can do.
Others are pushing for more diversity at major food industry events.
I still feel really determined to do, you know, whatever I can to help shift that and in a direction that's not just more diverse, but more equitable.
We also have a report on that summer business staple, the lemonade stand.
The lemonade stand might be the purest form of starting a business. Low overhead, easy to get into, and requires little experience or special equipment.
Don't miss Meat and Three, your weekly 15-minute food news roundup from HRN. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. Search MEAT plus sign THREE. And thanks, as always, for listening.
Hello, and welcome to Cutting the Curd. This is your host, Elena Santigade, and I'm just so happy right now, people. I have a cheese industry luminary here with me in the studio, and also a dear friend. Before I reveal the identity of our guest today, listeners, let's test your Cutting the Curd IQ. Our guest today has been on the show 5 times. His first appearance in the very first year that Ann Saxelby launched our show. His cheeses have won over 40 awards, and hint, we're only talking about 2 different cheeses here. And he himself won the 2017 Slow Cheese Award for his dedication to producing raw milk cheese. Listeners, our mystery guest has even been selected by Martha Stewart herself as a leader of the next generation of American artisans. Accolades aside, I dare you to find a cheesemonger who doesn't agree that today's guest makes 2 of America's most delicious, dependable, and enduring cheeses. Andy Hatch of Upland's Cheese Company, welcome to Cutting the Curd.
Thanks, Lena. Thanks for making me blush on air.
I love making Andy blush. Okay, so since I'm hoping that most of our listeners passed that little IQ test and guessed that it was you 1 or 2 facts in, I hope, I'm not going to go nuts with the introduction here. Andy is the owner and cheesemaker at Upland's, where he focuses mostly on one cheese, the Beaufort and Comté-inspired Pleasant Ridge Reserve, and at the end of the season, Rush Creek, America's answer to Vacheron Mont d'Or. Upland's is a farmstead operation with a super unique breed of dairy cows and some of the best pasture in Wisconsin. I'm excited to chat more about how things are going at Upland's, but first, I hear you recently went on a sales trip to Australia. And before today's show, I actually looked up our show downloads by city. And we do have some Australian listeners out there, believe it or not. So how would you sum up the current cheese climate down there? Is cheese a sexy, like, specialty food, or is it more utilitarian? Like, what's going on?
There's a lot of cheese being sold and eaten in Australia, and at a high price. I mean, there's a value placed there on cheese. The main cities, Melbourne and Sydney, are very different. Melbourne has a really strong, deep, long-standing cheese culture. There are, you know, permanent kind of bricks and mortar markets that have been around for over 140 years, and
wow,
half a dozen of these markets around the city, and each market will have half a dozen cheese stands in them, you know, each selling 70, 80 cheeses. I mean, there's a lot,
wow,
of cheese being sold. There are cheese boards on restaurants all over both of those cities.
Really?
There's a cheese only, you know, cheese and booze restaurant in Melbourne doing like 400 covers a night.
Oh my gosh.
On just cheese. I mean, so
that's amazing.
Yeah, there's a lot of cheese being sold, and domestically most of what's being produced is kind of industrial scale, but they,
right,
are there's a strong you know, early stage growth of artisan cheese making there. And so I went out, I was with Matteo from Jasper Hill.
Your buddy.
But he's actually there to carry my bags. He had his cheddar and I had Pleasant Ridge. So we were there to visit customers. We both sell cheese in Australia. But we were also brought over by the Australian Specialty Cheesemakers Association to talk to their members about, how to grow their farmstead and artisan cheese industry. And so normally when I travel, you're going to Europe and you get kind of a patronizing pat on the back, isn't it cute? Americans are making
really growing
too.
Up.
This is unusual because this was sort of the opposite experience where they're looking at us, American artisan cheesemakers, as a model they'd like to emulate. Wow. We're sort of, I would say maybe 20 years ahead.
Wow.
Where they are now feels like the late 90s in American cheesemaking. So that was really interesting.
Totally. And did that, how many cheesemakers are in that group roughly? Did you get a sense of?
Dozens, but not hundreds.
Okay. Very interesting. Yeah. So one question I had, I've always thought that Australia was pretty strict on raw milk cheeses. Oh. And I knew that there are some exceptions to their rules there, and they had some specific cheeses they were allowing for import, like Parmigiano. Has that loosened up? Did you feel that there's more of a openness to, well, first on the legality side of selling and making raw milk cheese, but also like culturally, are people familiar with the difference?
It's culturally bit of a divisive issue, in a way similar to here. There are hardcore proponents of fluid raw milk, and then there are people who think it's going to be the death of us all. And that conversation is happening. Legally, you're only allowed to sell raw milk cheese that has been cooked during the cheesemaking process to at least 120 degrees Fahrenheit. So Pleasant Ridge Reserve gets in.
Meets that requirement.
And so does, Gruyere, Comté, Reggiano. Right. But cheddars, which aren't cooked to that high of a temp, are all pasteurized. And then, so there's no soft cheese. The one exception, which is a remarkable story, is Roquefort is allowed in. And that was really the work of Will Studd.
Right, he was like a one-man army on that issue.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. So you do see, raw milk Roquefort, but otherwise hard cheese, and then the rest is pasteurized.
Hmm. So interesting. So let's talk about the mongers. You said that there's all these, shops, that there's a lot of cheese sales happening in Australia. Is the monger culture as passionate and reaching a cool factor like it is here in the States?
No, good question. And we talked a lot about that. We talked about sort of the culture amongst cheesemakers. There's a pretty strong sense of like fraternity here in the States that doesn't exist there. It's, clicky and a little bit divisive. And then, what we've gained from that as an industry has been a big deal. I maybe took for granted ACS and what that does for us. And their Specialty Cheesemakers Association is not that organized or yet. And then similarly on the cheesemonger side, there's not a monger culture that's strong, but we talked a lot about it, and a couple of mongers there have come over to the States. Anthony Femias, been over quite a few times at CMI. He spent some time at Jasper. He's got a market stall in Melbourne. There are a few young French mongers who are pretty sharp and ambitious, and then a lot of these market stalls in Melbourne are run by Greek families and Italian families.
Nice.
And it's not a young hip monger culture. It's an old family thing. But you've got a lot of those shops have, the owners on the floor, hardworking, and they know product, but it's...
Right. But it's not glorified or...
No.
There is sometimes a precious factor that can happen when you've got your really passionate mongers.
But we're going to try to bring a couple of... exciting young mongers we met. We're going to try to bring them over. And,
awesome.
I mean, I really want to help. And there's a model for it there. I mean, they're serious about coffee. And the barista thing makes sense to them. And, of course, their wine industry is...
Big.
Pretty developed.
I always say, in the U.S., I always think... I watch the craft beer culture grow in new cities, and I always think like, oh, soon they're ready for a cheese shop if there's a few good brewers, you know. I see that as like an indicator.
The pioneer species.
Yeah, so, yeah. But yeah, maybe Australia, it makes sense that it could be coffee.
Yeah, but they're hungry for knowledge. I mean, we gave a bunch of talks and events and sold them out. I mean, people wanted to come out and learn about cheese.
Wow, that's really interesting. And also, it going back to what you mentioned about the fact that there are so many restaurants serving cheese boards, that's something that I feel has really sort of fallen by the wayside in a larger scale way in the U.S. Like, we are not, especially here in New York, where we've had iconic restaurants that have focused on cheese, and there still are a few, of course. I'm surprised that it's not a more regular thing. So it's interesting to hear that.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's pretty strong in Wisconsin, where I spend most of my time. Mm-hmm. New York, I'm not qualified to say, but it certainly is not growing, is it?
No, it doesn't seem like it, especially, and maybe my viewpoint is skewed because with the margins in New York City, I think as a just product cost, it's a tricky thing to manage well.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the wastage and all of that. It wasn't elevated, but it was pretty simple. It was usually in Australia, three cheeses, white mold. This is like a Dauphinois or something.
Right.
A hard cheese and a blue cheese.
It was, I like that. You know, they all start with the basics, yeah, right? Maybe put a little Pleasant Ridge on there.
And they all had them at the end of the meal. Before sweets.
Interesting. And in Wisconsin, what do you do? Before the meal, you think, is more common?
Yeah, before, after.
Before, during, after.
Yeah. No.
On the way home.
You'd have cheese curds. You'd have fried cheese curds at like 4 or 5 o'clock.
Yeah, a little snack. Beer. That's a snack. 2,000 calorie snack. But, that's fine. Okay, so I know you've been exporting cheese to Australia for the past 5 years or so. And what did you expect from that experience? Like, that's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty dramatic change from selling locally or to US-based distributors. I'm curious about what you expected going into that and how the past 5 years or so has gone for you.
You know, originally it came about because I knew Will Studd, and the company to which we sell in Australia, Calendar Cheese, was his company that he started and grew and sold a few years ago.
So it wasn't so foreign in that way.
You know, Will came to our farm to film for Cheese Slices. Mm-hmm. And
listeners, if you haven't checked out Will Studd's Cheese Slices videos, they're amazing. I remember when those DVDs arrived in my mailbox years ago, and I was just so excited.
Yeah, I came back from Australia with a complete set.
Because
why not? I mean, I'll go back and watch them. They're really well done.
It's His books are well done. A visual reference, like a visual encyclopedia of major cheese styles.
Yeah, yeah, and you get to see inside all these French make rooms that they never let you in anyway. Yeah,
I know.
So Will's like, you know, hey, mate, let's bring your cheese over. And I was like, gosh, okay. And
did
that
you
was
respond
the original
in an Australian accent?
Yeah, right.
Okay, good.
Right. And it was pretty similar when we started selling cheese to Neil's Yard, and it was relationships that were already there, and it was a way to just, you know, do business with friends.
Right.
Now it's become more meaningful as, I think, sort of a new frontier new place to sell more cheese.
Right, right.
I think, you know, we previously, you and I were talking about, maybe we'll get into it today, the, you know, tightening up of the American artisan cheese market and what it means to try to sell more cheese in the States now, where arguably the production of artisan cheese has outpaced our ability to sell it in existing outlets. So I see it as a new place to sell cheese.
And a place where there's a value on it, like you mentioned, that might be different from the U.S. at this point, monetarily at least, the price people are willing to pay.
People are paying, you got to do some math here, which maybe we can challenge Elena with some on-air math.
Oh, where's my cell phone?
You've got, you know, they're selling a lot of cheese, 80 to 100, 110, 120 Australian dollars per kilo. So the rough math, you know, 2.2 pounds in a kilo, a buck, 28 or 22 Australian to US, $50, $60, $50 plus dollars a pound.
A pound. Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, and, you know, I...
So they value the cheese. And then everybody's getting there on a boat. The French cheese, the Australian, the Italian cheese. So we're competitive.
Right.
Price-wise. Whereas Europe, our cheese goes on a plane and it's crazy expensive.
Yeah,
it's never going to be a volume proposition. But I think I can sell a lot of cheese in Australia.
That's a really interesting difference, you know, in terms of like how the cheese gets there, determining how it's going to, you know, how competitive you're going to be able to be.
We have almost $7 a pound in transportation flying it to Europe.
Wow.
Just
that's amazing.
Yeah. And imports and, you know, tariffs.
Now, that actually, you know, makes me think of like over the past year, I've traveled a ton and it's been really fun. No special reason, just good opportunities to go around. And it's like I've been sitting in, listening to amazing music at Bacchanal in New Orleans, and I had some Pleasant Ridge Reserve. Right. I've been in like a dream marketplace in the middle of Stockholm, and I had some Pleasant Ridge Reserve. And it was like, these experiences for me, like running into your cheese around the world, it feels so deeply comforting. And especially amidst, especially overseas where you can, you know, everything's unfamiliar. And so I've had a real, really fun time seeking, especially your cheese out all over the world. And it made me think, you know, in terms of getting into the export market for cheesemakers here in the U.S. who are facing similar challenges, you know, like what advice do you think you would give to small or medium-sized cheesemakers who are having trouble kind of like making that P&L balance with the current climate of domestic sales?
Export market is probably not the easiest lever for them to pull.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, not many have done it also. Right?
Yeah. I mean, there's gotta be a demand for your cheese to begin with.
Right.
We've always been asked for our cheese, which is a nice way to start a conversation, but
totally.
Then you still have to go over there and talk to people and see the market, and so you've got to invest.
Investment in and of itself.
And so, if you're a you know a small cheesemaker working 19 hours a day and wearing you know 8 hats, and to fly over is difficult. Lucky I have this window in my year where I don't make cheese, where I can get away and do that. So I don't think export is an easy answer, but it's a good question, and it's in my mind a lot now. You know how to. What does this mean for mid-sized cheesemakers like us looking forward? Because when you do travel and leave home, you know, it makes you re-examine the way you do things at home. So you get to Australia and you say, oh, well, you know, the industry's behaving this way and that way. Well, we're different at home. Why are we different? You know, so you got to kind of get out of your pattern.
Expands your perspective a little.
And so I have, you know, been thinking about it a lot lately. And, of course, traveling with Matteo, he, I think, is a really original thinker when it comes to some of the economic dimension of cheese making, and he has this way he likes to describe the artisan cheese market as sort of a network of pipes running around the country, and we're producing cheese in these remote rural areas, and we're shooting cheese out in these pipelines, and then sucking cash
mnemonic
back
tubes.
In. Yeah, I mean, and you're really, you know, it's a vehicle for bringing money back into rural
into your
America.
Yeah, and your communities.
And so, you know, my thinking about what that looks like going forward, you know, how we're going to grow that, bring more money back into these rural areas.
Right.
I think there's cause for concern for these mid-sized producers like us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, last time I was on the show, Greg and I talked about you know, consolidation in the industry. And I'm not somebody who thinks a large company is inherently worse than a small one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of the consolidation we've seen, you know, instance by instance, it's hard to object to, you know. So
it doesn't
Amazon
seem to
bought
have had.
Whole Foods. Well, that could be great. You know, Kroger bought Murray's. Well, that was a nice exit for Rob. That could work out. You know, Emmy bought some cheesemakers. Well, you know, there's a lot of integrity in the people still making those cheeses.
Yeah, so, the products haven't suffered as much as we can see.
So, you know, I don't want to throw a flag on any one of those transactions, but what I'm worried about is that if this pattern continues, that we will end up in a place where there are you know, a smattering of small kind of farmers market scale producers, mm-hmm. You know, operating regionally. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you know, four or five big conglomerate right. producer companies
right.
selling through four or five conglomerate distributors
right.
to four or five conglomerate retailers.
Like a monoculture of cheese in the end, yeah, in
so,
a way.
And then in between this, you know, Uplands cheese scale, family scale producer with national distribution, all of a sudden starts to feel pretty lonely. And, you know, my worry is that these larger companies, you know, there's a kind of a gravitational pull for businesses to do business with other businesses their size.
Right.
And that all of a sudden this lonely territory of a family scale business could become awkward.
Right.
You need national distribution to make money.
Right, but you don't have all the resources to deal with a conglomerate setup in
yeah.
a way.
Or if there starts to get into price wars
right.
or, you know, if marketing becomes a big tipping point in driving sales, you can't compete with their marketing.
Right. And
so, I mean, I have concern about that personally, but I think all of us as an industry ought to take some time and think about what that future would look like.
A little visioning.
I mean, our natural inclination, mine included, is just to sort of think about your own organism.
Right.
I'm worried about my sales.
Right.
I'm worried about my cheese.
And then you have the day-to-day existence
and that's how we all operate. And if we continue on the path we're on, there's thinking in that way, there's a potential we get to a point where the industry looks like I just described, mm-hmm. and then we're all looking around like, how do we get here?
Right.
You know, we have very few independent companies. There's less interesting new cheese. Mm. There are less, you know, markets that can handle that cheese approach. So, and I have a couple of ideas, especially coming from Australia. I have a couple of thoughts on, you know, what we can do as an industry to kind of avoid that future. This is where I'm going to sound like I'm running for office. I have a three-point path to prosperity.
I'm very excited to hear you step onto this soapbox. But first, and this is a great cliffhanger to leave on, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back with Andy Hatch. We're going to hear his vision for the future.
Path to prosperity. Artisan cheesemakers. Number one, don't make cheese.
It starts in Wisconsin. Okay, we'll be right back.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh, and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the farmstead cheese company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious stinky Limburger and its long storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Sertori's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply, that produce the very best milk, fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd. I'm here with BFF of the show and humblest of cheesemaking royalty, Andy Hatch of Uplands Cheese Company. So, Andy, before the break... you were about to announce your platform for running for some sort of new office we haven't defined yet. Head visionary of cheesemaking in the U.S.
Cheese czar.
Cheese czar. United States cheese czar. Let's hear it.
This thinking, as I said, came out of a trip to Australia. So 2 weeks, whirlwind tour, visited, you know, 5, 6, 8 customers, producers a day. And when you go on that kind of trip, you get a snapshot of an industry.
Yeah, it's a real deep dive.
And makes you think about how it's set up structurally. And then, of course, you look back home and think about how we're set up structurally. And so it occurred to me that, you know, we need as an industry to invest in the vision of the future that we want.
Right.
And if we continue to simply think only about our own businesses, we might end up in a place we don't like, as mm-hmm. I described.
You know,
monoculture.
Yeah, and I think we've seen other industries, you know, you see that happen, and it feels like a force you can't control, when in reality it might be one that you can.
And so I came up with a couple of ideas that, you know, could be useful for producers, for distributors, and for retailers to keep in mind when, you know, thinking about the vision for the future. And then, so for producers, I think we need to continue to work cooperatively. And I think we do a pretty good job of that. That does not exist in Australia, and I think they are suffering for it. I think ACS is in a really strong place in general, but it's big and national scale and doesn't fit everybody. So I think, you know, regional cheese guilds seem to be doing pretty well, and that needs to continue. And I think offering each other technical support, especially in regards to food safety, is really important. And ACS has been really good at that lately. Sarah Spira and the, you know, Safe Cheesemaking Hub.
Right. Really
that needs to continue to happen on a regional and state level, so we don't have things happen like did with Volto. And,
right.
I also think cooperative marketing can be really effective. You know, I'm from Wisconsin. We have the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Now the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin.
New
just
branding.
Just renamed yesterday. But all that is farmers pooling their money together to help market themselves.
And it's an amazing force when you think of it. Because they're doing things for you that, you know, you can't really carve out of your own operations. You would never be able to do it on the scale and scope that they're doing it.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I also think... So you have, you know, trade associations, you have food safety, and you have guilds sharing information. And then I also think we're doing a pretty good job of kind of cooperative marketing events, CMI,
right.
Counterculture.
It's really growing.
You know, getting producers together who are small scale themselves, don't have huge marketing budgets, but they can then present themselves to the public, like, look, this is authentic cheese.
Right. We're doing things the real way.
Yes, you know, as opposed to chasing big, glossy, you know, marketing campaigns that none of us can afford. So, producer end, I think we're doing a lot of things right. And Wisconsin has got a lot more of those resources than other parts of the country.
Mm-hmm. But. Yeah, I also have liked that with counterculture specifically, they're going to cities that aren't, you know, the low-hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. Like New York City, cheesemongers gathering together is pretty easy to make that happen. But in places farther afield, you know, I think they have one coming up in Buffalo. You know, I think it's really...
Charlotte.
Yeah.
And that's a handy segue maybe to what I think retailers can be thinking about, and which is the second idea here. And the most important thing retailers can do in general is grow the market for artisan cheese. Now, that's obvious and easy to say, but you know, what are we, 370 million people in this country? There are a lot of
tons of people
buying a lot of cheese
eaters.
And I think that we need to concentrate on converting people from, you know, buying industrial cheese to buying artisan cheese.
It's really that education piece that's necessary.
So all of these kind of mid-sized companies that need to grow their sales, rather than duke it out with each other, for the existing customers, we need to, you know, find more customers and bring people over from crap cheese
to
good cheese. And so, easier said than done. And I think everybody probably agrees the big frontier there is selling cheese online, and everybody's thinking about it. Nobody's really figured it out.
Yeah, nobody has done a slam dunk there, which is really interesting.
And it may not happen. You know, it may be that people buying fine cheese want to be able to smell it, taste it, touch it. But if and when it does happen, I hope that, you know, the retailers doing it will be able to leverage all those, you know, efficiencies and convenience for small producers and not simply
to continue to drive the price down and the expectation of price.
Right. So on the retail end, I'd like to see more of that. And then finally, for distributors can play their part too in logistics.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a real challenge moving small quantities of cheese around the country, and that was stark in Australia. It's a big hot country,
right?
And moving cheese around is not easy, and again, there was a little bit of a lack of trust and cohesion there. A lot of small producers didn't trust distributors, and they were, you know, suspicious of each other. And I can't talk about the reasons for that. I mean, I'm not a part of that scene, but it made me think, you know, hear about how difficult it can be for a small producer to get his or her cheese out around the country. And so,
totally.
Those, we need to find efficient ways to do that for these small producers to get access to new markets. And there are, you know, some solutions that seem to work around the country. Provisions pulling out of Vermont sounds right. Like they do a pretty nice job.
Yeah, I think they do.
We've been doing a fair amount of kind of small-scale consolidation in Wisconsin. We have neighboring cheesemakers. They'll bring their cheese to our place, to our farm, to plop onto the Murray's pallet. Saxby's palette, the cowgirl palette.
Because if they're already coming to you, or if you're already shipping cheese to them, then you have one of those pneumatic tubes is already going to your door.
Let's fill it.
So that, yeah, fill that tube as big as you can.
Right.
And then suddenly you've helped people scale. Yeah.
And, you know, we talk about the consolidation that's happening amongst retailers. We talk about the consolidation that's happening amongst producers. Mm-hmm. It's happening with distributors too.
Hmm. Yeah.
And you know, the worry there is that as those distributors get larger, they're going to be less
inclined to go that extra.
Or just like I said, mile. You know, businesses are sort of gravitate to other businesses of the same size.
Right.
These huge distributors, are they going to be able to work with a tiny producer? And so. We need to find some models to make that work.
Now, it doesn't sound like Australia was a model for that. Do you think that there are models for that? That maybe even not in cheese, maybe in other industries where they've figured it out a little better in terms of connecting the dots?
I'm not smart on that. You know, I don't know. Coffee cooperatives come to mind.
I wonder how they
certainly,
do it.
I mean, talking about a pipeline for bringing money back to poor areas, that doesn't seem to be working.
Right. No.
They don't get enough money, the producers. But I don't know.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to, this is like sparking a little research project for me to think about like other industries that are consolidating logistically better to bring in small producers. And where we could learn something farther afield, maybe something that's not so obvious, maybe not even a food item. Listeners, if anybody has any ideas, please email me cuttingthecurd@heritageradionetwork.org, or you can tweet us.
Don't tweet me.
Don't tweet Andy. He's going to be too busy. You're not on Twitter, Andy?
Not yet.
What with this platform, I think.
Yeah,
this may be the launch of your...
That's right, my 2020 candidacy.
For Cheese Czar.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is that, would you say that sums up this vision for the future of what we need to work on?
Yeah, and to be clear, this vision was written, you know, while eating an egg sandwich at Foster Sundry this morning.
I mean, delicious.
I think producers need to continue to work cooperatively, take advantage of the resources and share resources, especially in regards to food safety, especially in regards to distribution, and not think only about ourselves or you know.
Right.
I think retailers need to try to convert more customers from industrial cheese to good cheese.
Yeah.
And grow the market for all of us. And then I think distributors need to get better at moving cheese around the country from small producers and helping them grow markets in that way.
Yeah, and you know, with each of these points, I feel like there's just a win-win for everybody. On each side of the equation here, we're winning.
Sell less boring cheese, sell more good cheese.
Yeah, grow the market for all of us. Everybody will, you know, some people respond to, you know, dollars. Well, this is a way to make more of them, so let's do it, you know. I think that this is really exciting, actually. I wasn't prepared for such an amazing platform, although I should have been, because I know that you're thinking about this stuff all the time, and your perspective is so unique. But I feel like, listeners, we have some work to do. This is thoughtful work that anybody interested in the cheese industry plays a part in a real way. So I really like the charge and the vision you're giving to us here, Andy.
Well, I'm about to go home and start calving and cheese making and go back to my own little silo.
Go into the tunnel.
Of thought. So you caught me at the, you know, the end of the brainstorming season. But there are other people smarter than me at, mm-hmm. when thinking about these issues. We just need to keep, you know, talking about it.
And
working on it.
And really holding each other accountable. I think that's a big piece too. Wow. I feel so inspired. You know what? I could talk to you for hours here, but I feel like that was such a rich chunk of information that I'm going to let our listeners sort of munch on that hunk of cheese for a while.
I'm going to go munch on a slice of Roberta's pizza.
I don't know how this analogy, how well I did there, but Andy, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Yeah. This was a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me. I'm so happy to see you behind the mic here. I think you're a great fit for a great show.
Aw, geez, now you're making me blush. Yeah. All right. So listeners, thank you for listening. And if by some chance you haven't had Pleasant Ridge Reserve yet, well, I hope you're listening to this on the way to the cheese shop. I'm Elena Santigade, and we'll be back next week with more Cutting the Curd.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. No.